feel compelled to do more much sooner.
Our political editor, Chris Mason, BBC News.
And the news is read by Jane Steele. Later this evening on Radio 4, we'll hear how seriously mentally ill people in prison are being refused the hospital treatment that they need. Annabelle Dees reports in the new series of File on 4. That's tonight at 8 o'clock. Now, a look ahead to this weekend.
The finals of the FA Cup.
Before any leagues anywhere in the world came the FA Cup.
On Saturday, Chelsea play Liverpool in the men's final.
It's North versus South, it's Red versus Blue, it's Klopp versus Tuchel.
Then on Sunday, it's Chelsea versus Manchester City in the women's.
City lead, and it's Ellen White!
And that could send Chelsea to Wembley.
Get all the FA Cup final action, Saturday from 4:45.
Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
And now on Radio 4, Just William Live. Martin Jarvis performs one of Richmal Crompton's classic stories, recorded at the Orange Tree Theatre in Richmond. It's Just William as stand-up, in front of a packed house.
William and the Musician. William Brown sat on the crest of the hill, his chin cupped in his hands. From his point of vantage, he surveyed the wide expanse of country that swept out before him. And as he surveyed it, he became the owner of all the land and houses as far as the eye could see. Farther than he could see. Casting aside the hampering bonds of possibility, he became the ruler of all England, finding the confines even of England too cramping for him. He became the ruler of the whole world. He made sweeping and imperious gestures at which the thousands of invisible minions around him trembled. A rebellion was announced in a remote part of his empire. With a wide movement of his arm, William sent out a vast army with instructions to show the rebels no quarter. Immediately afterwards, the army returned, bringing with it the leaders of the rebellion in chains. A fierce gesture ordered them off to instant imprisonment. Another movement pinned medals onto the breasts of the victorious generals. It was at this point that William realized that he was not alone. A small man had climbed the hill and now sat by him, watching him with interest. Near the small man was a huge pack. "Well," he said, as William turned to meet his eye, "did you catch it?"
"Catch what?" said William.
"The mosquito you were trying to catch." "I thought you got him that last grab."
William, unwilling to admit any kind of failure, said coldly, "Yes, I got him all right."
"You took a long time over it."
"Did I?" Then he swept his arm around in another wide circle and said, "All that land belongs to me. It's mine as far as you can see." The man was evidently of an ingenuous disposition. He had a humorous, pathetic face, rather like a monkey. He looked impressed.
"All of it," he said, "as far as you can see on every side."
William put the true artistic touch of restraint into his picture. "Well, not quite as far as you can see. As far as that tree on one side and as far as the river on the other." The little man surveyed this extensive stretch of land with deepening interest. Then he looked at William.
"But you're underage, of course. I suppose you have a guardian or agent of some sort to manage it for you."
"Oh, yes, yes, yeah, I have a guardian or agent, all right." The little man was still impressed.
"Your parents are both dead, of course."
"Oh, yes, yes." "My parents are both dead, all right. They died the day I was born. Struck by lightning."
"Oh, how terrible."
"Yes, it was, yes. I was awfully upset at the time. But I soon got over it, and on the whole, I'd as soon not have parents as have them." In imagination, he saw a glorious existence in which he climbed forbidden trees, played in forbidden ponds, turned the garden into a jungle, and never went to bed at all. A jolly sight sooner, in fact. The little man's gaze wandered again over the expanse of William's alleged estate.
"And where do you live?"
he said. The most imposing house within sight was the hall. William pointed to it. "I live there," he said. As a matter of fact, the hall was rather in the public eye at present, as Mr. Bott, of Bott's Sauce fame, had returned there with his wife and daughter after a long absence. Lest their return should pass unnoticed, Mrs. Bott had given a staggering donation to the rebuilding of the local cottage hospital. The result was that the chairman of the hospital, Lord Faversham, was coming down from London to attend a garden party at the hall, to which the entire neighbourhood was being invited, and which was to assure forever Mrs. Bott's place among the neighbouring aristocracy. William had heard nothing else mentioned in the village for days past. "I'm giving a large party there next Saturday," he said nonchalantly. "Lord Faversham's coming to it." He had checked an impulse to substitute the King for Lord Faversham's name, but couldn't resist adding, "and a lot more dukes and earls and things." He suddenly caught sight of a little dog lying on the ground behind the pack, fast asleep. "I say, is that your dog?"
"Oh, yes, it's Toby. Wake up, Toby. Show the gentleman what you can do, Toby."
Toby woke up and showed the gentleman what he could do. William watched him ecstatically. "I say, he's splendid. I've never seen such a clever dog. Hi, Toby, come here, old chap." Toby was a jolly, friendly little dog. He ran up to William and played with him and growled and pretended to bite him and rolled over and over. And then, at the word of command, sprang up to shoulder his stick and walk about with it.
"Never was such a dog," said the little man. "Laps up tricks like a cat milk, but do people want him? No. Punch and Judy's out of date, they say. No use for a Punch and Judy show nowadays. I don't know what the world's coming to."
"What? You got a Punch and Judy show?" The man nodded and pointed to his pack, on which the faded letters Signor Manelli could faintly be seen.
"Yes, same as my father had before me. Fine thing when a dog like Toby's told he's out of date. Nobody wants to see him."
"I bet anyone will want to see him," said William fervently. The little man shook his head sadly and became confidential. He was actually an Italian, he said, and had come to England with his father and mother when he was only a few weeks old. His ambition was to make enough money to go back to Italy. It was an ambition, however, that he'd almost given up hopes of fulfilling.
"Turn up their noses, they do. Hardly enough to keep us alive is all we get nowadays, me and Toby."
"Well, I like Punch and Judy," said William. "And if..." The little man interrupted him.
"Listen, this party you're giving, couldn't you engage us for that? I promise we'd give you our best performance. Your guests wouldn't be disappointed."
Yes, of course.
"I'll come then. What time does it begin?"
3 o'clock, but I'm afraid, you see,
No, it's all right, I promise. I promise I won't disappoint your guests. You won't regret it. I thank you from my heart."
He had leapt to his feet and was already shouldering his pack.
3 o'clock on Saturday, and we'll practice in the meantime till we're fit to perform before the King, won't we, Toby?"
And already he was swinging down the hill.
Wait a minute.
But the little man was already out of sight and earshot. The world potentate sat with his head in his hands, wondering how to deal with this new, staggering crisis. Visions of his new friend arriving at Mrs. Bott's party with his Punch and Judy show, only to be ignominiously ejected, sent hot and cold tremors up and down his spine. Well, the only possible way out was to run after the little man and make a clean breast of the whole thing. So William set off hastily towards the main road. There was no sign of anyone, only disappearing in the distance a bus, on the top of which William could just discern the small, bowed figure of his friend. At breakfast next morning, his mother said, They're going to have an entertainment. What sort of an entertainment? Said William.
Zevrier, the violinist, said Mrs. Brown. He's really famous, you know, and terribly modern.
I know a man... don't you think people would rather have a Punch and Judy show than a violinist?
A Punch and Judy show? Don't be so ridiculous, William. It's not a children's party.
Well, no. I suppose not. By the time the day arrived, however, William's natural optimism had reasserted itself. The little man had, of course, taken the whole thing as a joke. Still, he couldn't help remembering that gentle, monkey-like face. He didn't look the sort of man who took things as jokes. As William wandered about among the guests, he kept an anxious eye upon the entrance gates. As the moments passed by and no Signor Manelli appeared, his spirits lightened. Lord Faversham, a tall man wearing an expression of acute boredom, was being ushered by a perspiring Mrs. Bott into the tent where Zevrier's recital was to take place. Mrs. Bott had considered it a stroke of genius to have secured Zevrier.
"The swells like that sort of thing," she had explained to her husband. "They don't like real music with a tune."
The expression of boredom on his lordship's face intensified almost to agony as Mrs. Bott led him to the Gothic armchair in the middle of the front row. Then Mrs. Bott went outside to look up and down anxiously for Zevrier. The tent full of people began to grow restive. It was 3:15, and still there were no signs of Zevrier. The audience didn't particularly want to hear Zevrier, but it had come to hear him, and it wanted to get it over. Mrs. Bott, her large face now rivaling the colour of her husband's famous sauce, went into the library where Mr. Bott had sought temporary refuge with a stiff whiskey and soda.
"Oh, Botty, he's not come," she said hysterically.
"Who's not come?" said Mr. Bott gloomily.
"Zebra, the violin man. Oh, Bossy, what shall I do? They'll all be laughing at me. That there lord will go back to London laughing at me. I'll never hold up my head again. Oh, Bossy, isn't it awful?"
Mr. Bott had dreaded this affair for months. "Well, I can't help it," he said. "You would have all this. I warned you it wouldn't come to no good."
"But, Bossy, they're all waiting and nothing happening and all getting so cranky. Can't you do something, Bossy?"
"What can I do? I can't play the violin."
"No, but... Oh, dear. I'll go and see what's happening now."
A little crowd of indignant figures had left their chairs and congregated round the tent door.
"Well, really," they were saying, "how much longer does she think we're going to wait?"
William had been hovering outside the tent. At this point, he turned round and saw a small, pack-laden figure approaching. His heart froze within him as the figure came up to him.
"Oh, my little host, I'm so sorry to be so late. The bus broke down. That is what has made me so late. Ah, here are your guests, all ready for me. I will waste no more time."
Still speaking, he entered the tent, mounted the little platform that had been prepared for Zevrier, and began to set up his miniature stage. William stood for a moment in sheer horror. Then, his courage suddenly failing him, began to run down the drive and along the road that led to his home. He knew of a good place of concealment. But just as he was rounding the corner of the Hall estate, he ran into a strange figure. A figure wearing an open collar, flowing tie, and a shock of long, carefully waved hair. It carried a violin case. There was no doubt at all. It was Zevrier. William was going to hasten past when he noticed the musician's expression, ill-tempered, querulous. He remembered the appealing, rather helpless friendliness of the little Punch and Judy man. He imagined the inevitable clash between them, the fury of the musician, the public humiliation of his little friend. Again, a nightmare closed over him. Please, he began. The musician stopped short and scowled at him.
"Yes."
Are you going to the hall?
"Yes,"
snapped the musician. "To play to 'em?"
"Yes."
"Are you Mr. Zevrier?" I am the vrai, said the man, tossing back his hair and striking an attitude. Well, I wouldn't go and play to him if I was you, said William desperately. Why not? I just wouldn't if I was you. That's all. The musician was feeling particularly annoyed that afternoon. He was engaged in writing his autobiography, and he couldn't find anything interesting to put into it. He wanted it to abound in picturesque episodes, and he couldn't think of even one picturesque episode. He had made his reputation for genius by defying the established rules of technique, and he had an uneasy suspicion that it was beginning to collapse. He was writing the book in order to bolster it up. Moreover, he disliked Mrs. Bott, though he had never met her. She was under a misapprehension about his name and began all her letters to him, Dear Mr. Zebra. This had annoyed him so much that he'd almost decided not to come and was still in two minds about it. Pigs, he burst out suddenly. They are pigs, buying immortal genius by the hour, as if it were tape at so much a yard. Yes, said William, anxious to prolong the conversation. Yes, that's just what I think about it. You? How can you understand? Well, no, I do understand. I do understand. I mean, you tell me a bit more about what you feel about it. I mean, I want to know what you feel about it. William's attitude was that every word postponed the inevitable moment of reckoning. You don't know what music is to me, said the musician, striking his chest dramatically. Yes, I do, said William, solely for the sake of argument. Experience had taught him that with a little care and skill, any argument can be prolonged almost indefinitely. You don't love music. Yes, I do. It isn't life and breath to you. Yes, it is. The musician looked at William closely. William's expression was guileless and innocent. He could not know, of course, that William was probably the most unmusical boy in the British Empire. Then Zevrier remembered an anecdote he'd once heard about some musician or other. The musician, on his way to play at a party, had met a child lover of music and played to him all the afternoon, completely forgetting the party. It was just the sort of anecdote that he wanted for his memoirs. A different type of boy would be better for the story, but a little poetic license in descriptions is always allowed to writers of autobiographies. Those pigs will talk. Talk while I play, he said, waving his violin case in the direction of the hall. William agreed. Yes, they will. They talk all the time. I jolly well wouldn't play to them if I was you. Suppose, said the musician, tossing back his long hair, suppose I played to you instead. Would it be something that you'd remember all your life? Yes, said William, fixing an idiotic smile upon his lips. I will, said the musician, already beginning to compose the anecdote with picturesque additions in his mind. Let us go. His gaze rested on a haystack in a field next to the road. That would look well in a book of memoirs. Perhaps some artist would even be inspired to paint the scene with an idealized boy, of course. Let us go there. At the haystack, Zevrier sat down in the shade of it with William next to him and drew out his violin. He played for a quarter of an hour. Then Zevrier looked at William. William had a look of rapt attention on his face. The musician could not know, of course, that in sheer boredom, William was engaged in addressing his army on the eve of a great battle. Zivrier played again. Then again, he looked at William. "Another one," said William in a peremptory tone of voice that the musician took to be one of fervent appreciation. He could not know, of course, that William was now a pirate and was ordering his men to send yet another captured mariner along the plank. Zivrier played again. Then he again looked at William. William's eyes were closed as if in ecstasy. He could not know, of course, that William was asleep. He played again. The clock struck five. William sat up and heaved a sigh of relief. "I've got to go home now. It's after my tea time." Zevrier glanced at him coldly and decided that the boy should make quite a different sort of remark in his memoirs. They went back to the road in silence and there parted William to his home and the musician to the station. At 3:20, Mrs. Bott, still purple-faced, had spoken to her butler.
"Mr. Zebra hasn't come yet, Jenkins, has he?"
"No, madam, I believe not," said the butler.
"It's horrible. I believe he's let me down on purpose. I do really. You don't do anything, do you, Jenkins?"
"Do anything, madam?"
"Well, sing or recite or do conjuring tricks or anything."
"No, madam."
"Well, I've got to have something done for them. I used to do a skirt dance, very pretty when I was a girl, but I'm past it now. It'll be the death of me. I'll never live it down. I could kill that Zebra."
"He may have come by now, madam, and gone straight to the tent."
"Oh, well, I'll go and see. After all I've done for them hospitals, to be let down by a man with a name like something out the zoo."
She went slowly down to the tent. To her amazement, a burst of loud laughter and clapping greeted her. She peeped in at the open flap. Still more to her amazement, a Punch and Judy stage was set up on the platform, and a Punch and Judy performance was in full and merry swing. "Eh? I'm dreaming. Where's Zebra? Where did this thing come from? I must be dreaming." Her eyes went to the noble lord. He was leaning forward in his seat, laughing uproariously. After the first moment's stupefaction, everyone else had settled down to follow his example and enjoy the show. Signor Manelli was a born comedian, and Toby had a fine appreciation of the ludicrous and liked applause as much as his master. He carried his little sword with a swagger. The whole thing was a relief to nerves keyed up to an hour's intensive torture at the hands of a Zevrier.
What's happened?"
murmured Mrs. Bott wildly.
"I've gone potty. That's what's happened. This whole thing's been too much for my brain."
But the performance was drawing to a close amid a riot of applause. The noble lord had mounted the platform and was shaking Signor Manelli by the hand.
"Bravo! Bravo! I've not enjoyed anything so much for years, not for years. And now look here, I want to book you for a party at my place in town next month. Have you a free date?"
Arrangements were quickly made. A fee was named at which Signor Manelli almost fainted in sheer surprise. Suddenly, the noble lord saw Mrs. Bott standing in the doorway of the tent, the expression of surprise upon her face making it strongly resemble that of an expiring fish.
"Ah," he said genially, "here is our hostess to whom we owe this delightful entertainment."
Signor Manelli started forward to her eagerly,
"And where is my little host?"
The mystery was suddenly clear to Mrs. Bott. Botty, in the kindness of his heart, must have secretly engaged this man for her to fall back on in case the Zebra person didn't turn up. My little host was a bit of a cheek, of course, but never mind.
"Oh, he's resting in the library," she said.
I won't disturb him then, said Signor Manelli, but give the dear little man my most grateful respects and tell him that I shall never forget his kindness to me. Oh, yes, I'll tell him. And at once she was surrounded by an eager crowd congratulating her on the success of her entertainment. He's a genius. How did you find him, Mrs. Bott? I've never laughed so much for ages. I'd heard it was going to be Zevrier, and he's so frightfully, frightfully modern that, to be quite frank, I was dreading it. Of course, the world's just ready for a revival of the Punch and Judy show. It's so clever of you to hit the exact moment, Mrs. Bott. To her amazement, Mrs. Bott discovered that she was, at last, somebody. When her guests had departed, she sought out her husband, who was still resting in the library. Oh, Botty, I thought I was going potty, Botty. But how kind, how thoughtful of you to think of it. I shall never forget it, never. He laid his hand gently on her shoulder. You go and lie down, my dear. The excitement's gone to your head. It was several months later. William sat at the table, ostensibly engaged upon his homework. Mrs. Brown was reading the paper and keeping up a desultory conversation with Ethel. It says here that Punch and Judy is still all the rage in London, said Mrs. Brown, but that Signor Manelli, who started it, is making no more engagements because he's going back to Italy. Do you remember him, dear? We saw him at that party of Mrs. Bott's. Oh, yes, said Ethel. And here's something about that Mr. Zevrier, the musician that Mrs. Bott once thought of having to her party, you know, before she decided to have the Punch and Judy. What? Said Ethel, absently. Well, his book of memoirs has just been published, and he quotes an extract from it here, all about a musical child that he met when he was going to play at some sort of party, and he stayed playing to it and forgot the party and his fee and everything. She looked up. I wonder if it could possibly have been... You know, people said that Mrs. Bott had engaged him for her party, as well as the Punch and Judy show, and he didn't turn up. Could it have been here that he met this musical child? What sort of a child was it? Said Ethel. Well, it quotes the description from the book. Here it is. He had deep-set dark eyes and a pale oval face, sensitive lips and dark curly hair. I saw at once that to him as to me, music was the very breath of life. Ethel laughed shortly. No, it couldn't have been here. There isn't any child like that around here. His head bent over the chief dates of the Wars of the Roses, and shielded by his hands, in the attitude of one who wishes to devote himself entirely to study and shut out all disturbing influences, William grinned to himself.